Is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to do some housekeeping first and introduce some bills. I also want to make clear that there's been some rumors that we're going to do the big revenue bill today or something, and I don't know where those are. There is a ballot measure bill that's out there that's not quite done yet, but even when it does get done, and even when we do introduce it in this committee, that's not the bill. I wish it was, but we need vehicles and ballot measures, and so. But that I'm still optimistic. It's going to happen. It's just not going to be today. Senator Boquist.
Are we in a work session?
We'll open work session for possible bill introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move LC 3279, dated 1/30/17, being introduced as committee bill, and I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves LC 3279 to be introduced as a committee bill. Senator Boquist, discussion?
Just a reminder, colleagues and members of the public, the introduction of a legislative concept is simply a discussion point and a starting point. It doesn't reflect any member's position, whether they're voting yes or no on the introduction. Thank you.
Thank you. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Arnie is here on 145.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, okay. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 145. We have a couple of distinguished members here, Senator Ferrioli and Senator Roblin. Are you both speaking to this?
We have eight.
Both on the same side?
20
I hope.
Words and 20 people to testify. That's not how it works.
Well,
not 60 page bill. One
person I'll be sitting to his right.
Way far to his right. I'll defer.
Okay. You're the senior member on LCIS.
Right to left or left to right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's on the left, isn't he, of me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From their perspective. Only if you look through a certain prism.
So for the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am a senator from District 5, from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and over into the valley in Polk and Yamhill counties. There is a Legislative Commission on Indian Services, organization which we began here a number of years ago to help strengthen the relationship between tribal governments and our state government. It has been, I believe, an amazing organization. And part of that, we have conversations, and more than a few times I've had the distinct pleasure to work with my colleague to my left.
Far right.
Oh, far right. Okay. To my right. Because these are issues that really strengthen our relationships between our nine recognized tribes and the state of Oregon. This is another one of those examples of a bill that came a number of years ago, giving these enterprise zones tax credits that even the playing field between our nine tribes and their sovereign rights and our governments, which we have given rights to have enterprise zones and have tax credits. And it isn't that we use it all the time. I think there's only really been one tribe, Gumatilla, that's actually done a lot of this. The issue is when people are looking around on where to invest and where to build, sometimes this is the tipping point with regard to whether they choose to go there or not because it's available. Whether they use it or not is another story. And so what we're asking here is to remove the sunset that's been there for a while. I'm certainly open. I think all tax credits have sunset, so we'll have to work on that one. But the reality is, my feeling is, as long as other government entities in our state are having this ability, we should make sure that our good partners and their sovereign rights are protected to continue to have the same opportunities as they look out for their communities and how they could develop their tribal lands. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. We probably should have started off with a little
background
summary. However, the former Senate Revenue Chair probably could give us his perspective on the background here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ted Ferrioli, District 30, all the rest of Oregon. So between the two of us, we can just solve problems. the nine federally recognized Indian tribes can have a single reservation enterprise zone. That's part of the background of this bill. Mm-hmm. Each tribe can enter into special intergovernmental agreements with city, ports, or county districts to directly create or co-sponsor any number of contiguous representative partnership zones. But this bill specifically talks about tribal sovereign lands.
That's right.
It is designed to prevent double taxation on those tribal sovereign lands. They are currently subject to state taxes as well as tribal government taxes if this enterprise zone would disappear.
Right.
We don't want it to disappear. We initially looked at the idea of extending the sunset date, and then we looked very hard at what does this cost Oregonians, because every time we give tax money away, we should be asked to be accountable for what the cost is and who benefits. The cost of this between 2010 and 2014 was a total of $30,000. That's the revenue foregone by this exemption. That really amounts to, if you divide that over the 14 taxpayers who have used this tax credit to advantage to create jobs on tribal lands, which, by the way, have an unemployment rate approaching 50% in some cases, it's about $6,000 per year. The credit's absolutely necessary for those enterprises that exist so that they can continue to offer employment in the reservations. We would like to ask this committee to move the bill forward, which eliminates the sunset. We understand that folks may have a philosophical argument about all bills having sunsets and all tax credits having sunsets. I would argue that because this unique program deals with sovereign nations, that it stands as an example of one that should be looked at as possibly the exception that proves the rule. So I'd like to see the committee, and I think my colleague would, and I know then the treaty tribe members who are here in support of the bill also would like to ask you to recognize the sovereignty of those nine sovereign nations within Oregon and pass the bill that eliminates the sunset. We recommend the bill to the committee's wisdom for consideration and urge its passage.
We.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Absolutely.
Any questions? Well, we're going to dive into this bill. Thank you both for your presence here, and I'm sure the tribal members appreciate your advocacy.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Chairman,
very much.
And members of the committee.
Yes.
Chair, could Chris now revenue speak this thing for us?
Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you just heard, the bill as drafted removes the sunset date for these tax credits, not the enterprise zones themselves, just the allowable tax credit. And it is, because it was one of the sunset group this time, it was part of the tax credit report. And what you have in OLIS is most of the text pertaining to this tax credit. And as is shown up there on the screen, you can see that the policy purpose says that it's to remove the disincentives that currently inhibit private businesses and industry from locating and operating enterprises within the boundaries of the rural Indian reservations of the state. So the revenue impact, there's just a paragraph there. It doesn't have the usual detail that the other credits do, and that's primarily because in many years there are so few taxpayers, we start to run into disclosure issues. So I just kind of averaged the numbers over the 10 years between 05 and 14. There is other text that it's all of the, in the tax credit report, all of the discussion about the enterprise zones is kind of melted together. So there's more discussion in the tax credit report, but the bottom line there, there's a, at the bottom of the page there, there's some recommendations, and given the policy purpose, there's a recommendation to eliminate the sunset date. There's advantages and disadvantages of the tax credit, and it is a bit different from other tax credits where there are metrics that can be measured over time to achieve a policy purpose, and this is, it's kind of a toggle thing, if you will.
Can you give us a hypothetical of how this would, the mechanics involved, the business?
Oh, the business, if they're paying the taxes.
It's Chris's burger and grill joint. So what?
So if I'm eligible, if I'm in one of these enterprise zones, and I'm in the eligible area, and I'm paying taxes to the tribal government, when I file my Oregon income tax return, I claim a credit for that amount of tax that I paid to the tribal government.
But if you're in an enterprise zone, you qualify for lower property taxes?
Potentially.
Okay.
You have an enterprise zone that basically it's a geographic area. You draw a circle around an area, if you will. I mean, they're more complicated than that. But then eligible businesses who make eligible investments can get property tax exemptions for those investments. For a period of time. And one of the things that this talks that I mentioned in the report is that it's somewhat similar to the tax credit paid to other states. So that's kind of where the analysis in the tax credit report landed. But the tax credit, the ease of administration is simply that they look at the tax that they pay to the tribal government, and that's the amount of credit that they can claim on the return, on their corporate income, or their Oregon income tax return.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
So the tax credits that we pay to other states, are they sunsetted?
No, they've never had a sunset. Back in 2009, when the assembly went through all, it was
right,
55 or 60, and put sunsets, and there were three groups.
Mm-hmm.
Three tax credits were not given a sunset date. The taxes paid to other states, because it was viewed as kind of an equalizing thing, mm-hmm, across the states for state-level taxation. The personal exemption credit, which has been modified over the time, but that one, so many taxpayers claim it, it's part of the base system, and it's a way of implementing a zero-rate tax bracket. And then there's a claim of right income, which is a very technical tax credit, but it is basically a refund of taxes that had been paid improperly. So it's kind of a refund of an error, kind of correcting an error in taxes paid. And so those three were not given a sunset date.
And I saw that in the analysis, this is about enterprise zones that are on reservations, but I understand that these are not all on reservations. They're in tribal lands, which is different than reservation.
Right, this particular tax credit, as you heard in the testimony, is tribal land.
Okay.
Tribal land or tribal reservations? Your text says reservations up there.
Okay, we have some people from the Umatilla tribes here. You want to bring your Tina? I've got Rosenda, Bill, Dave.
This is Orr.
If you want to come up.
Hey, this is reservation, not tribal land. It's just much more restrictive. So we need to find that out.
There's a distinction?
Yes, there is.
There is a big distinction.
Yes, there is a distinction.
Okay.
One territory is smaller than the other territory. But Mr. Chair, my other observation is this is sort of like the fire insurance fund. Somebody a long time ago decided we were going to do this different than everybody else.
Let's get into that discussion again. Okay. Welcome. Go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. My name is Rosenda Shippentower, and I'm an elected official of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And we are one of two treaty tribes in the state of Oregon. And I'm the treasurer of the Board of Trustees, as I mentioned before, that's an elected official. And today I am joined by our tax administrator, Bruce Zimmerman, who is the Enterprise Zone Manager for the CTUIR Reservation Enterprise Zone, and also our executive director, Dave Tovey, of the tribe. So, okay, I'm here to testify that our tribe, CTUIR, strongly supports SB 145, which would repeal the sunset of the reservation tax credit. The reservation enterprise zone designation and tax credit provision are essential for marketing commercial and industrial land for economic development, and ultimately The designation is a vehicle for creating jobs in rural Oregon. As we know, we in the rural Oregon are always, you know, needing some kind of economic development. And we not only provide jobs for our reservation community, we provide jobs for the surrounding area. So it's just a real benefit to our whole community, not just the reservation, with the reservation zone designation. And I know that you folks have just heard some of the history from Senator Farioli on this bill, but as we know, this designation zone was established in 2001. And shortly after it was established, the CTUIR applied, and we were designated as the first reservation enterprise zone in Oregon. And this timing was excellent because our tribal leadership had already started planning a business park the year before, and through our land development code, we'd established a 700-acre parcel of land for commercial and industrial development. And about that same time, we'd purchased an old truck stop that was located off of Interstate 84. And then from 2002 to 2007, we'd begin investing in infrastructure improvements to establish the Coyote Business Park, which is located 6 miles east of Pendleton. And in 2007, the first business to locate and take advantage of the enterprise zone was Cayuse Technologies. And Cayuse Technologies provides business support and technology services for government agencies and corporations and large and small businesses. And some of the technology services covers everything from design to testing and data analysis. So it's going pretty good now, and we employ a lot of people there. And when we first started with our truck stop, there were 30 people that were employed. And now, with the help of the Reservation Enterprise Zone designation, the business park is home to businesses with over 450 employees. And also, the tribe has invested nearly $37 million of infrastructure development, land acquisition, and buildings in this area. And in addition to the business park, we have established the Wanapah Industrial Park at the Port of Umatilla. And this is 40 miles northwest of Pendleton on the Columbia River. And with your help, we hope to grow more jobs there as well. And I'd like to thank you for your consideration, and we urge a due pass recommendation to your colleagues on the floor of the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You guys want to weigh in as well?
Well, just a couple things, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I think you were having a discussion about the definition of reservations. And as you know, land tenure in the state of Oregon is pretty complex, at least for the treaty tribes, Warm Springs and us. There's kind of a defined reservation where other restored tribes have had to buy back pieces of land and convert them to trust and try to maintain community, but still have scattered tracts around. And it's often hard to define. And several years ago when we were developing an update to this legislation, we tried to get a better definition of Indian country built in there. And at that time, and at the time I was working for the Sletz tribe, and their Sletz Tribal Business Corporation, we also developed a partnership zone in part to help overcome those. And at the time we started working down the path, of working with the Port of Toledo on some property the Sletz tribe owned there that was industrial, to where we could kind of use that property tax in their jurisdiction and taxation to generate the tax credit. We never did finish that completely, but it was a good opportunity for two jurisdictions to work cooperatively locally on economic development together. The other reality, I think, and Bruce will probably drill down on this a little bit more, is it doesn't, you know, the establishment of a business doesn't automatically create a tax credit, if you will. They have to have other eligible tax liabilities across the state off the reservation. So some of our businesses that might be unique and the only location in the state of Oregon don't enjoy that credit. In effect. So that's, you know, that's another feature. I think the last thing I want to point out is you can imagine when a company comes and talks to a reservation, they're uncertain of a whole bunch of things, our regulatory system, security of investment, political problems. And to have this partnership with the state of Oregon gives us, if you will, a good housekeeping seal of approval that we kind of work through these systems and they're able to kind of ensure that their investment and operations will continue unimpeded. So with that, I'll leave it to my colleague, Bruce. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Bruce Zimmerman, and I am the tax administrator for the Umatilla Tribes. But as part of my job functions, I'm also the enterprise zone manager. Since I deal with taxes and so forth, this is a very important tool for us when it comes to discussions with potential developers. Obviously, location is key as to where they want to locate a business. And then they look at other things like workforce, and then they look at the regulatory regulations that would impact them, and oftentimes taxes is at the top of their list, and they want to know what the tax regime is, what the regulations are, and how they can comply. And oftentimes they're looking at ways to eliminate you from their list of consideration. So the ability to show that we're in partnerships with the state of Oregon through an enterprise zone is viewed very favorably, that you have two jurisdictions, the state of Oregon and a tribal government, working in tandem together to create an environment that is conducive to positive economic development. I also wanted to comment about specifically the tax credit, and the analogy to taxes paid to another state is very accurate and on point. And I wanted to indicate that the tribe does have a property tax system called the Coyote Business Park tax. It is a tax. The tax rate is $20 per thousand, or 2% of the fair market value. So it's very similar to what you would find off reservation on property tax systems in other jurisdictions. There is one unique feature of the Coyote Business Park tax, in that the tax revenues derived from the taxpayers have to be reinvested back into the Coyote Business Park. We're using those tax revenues to help fund the infrastructure, to fund the debt service that we had borrow money to put in the roads, water, and sewer, and those items. So the revenue that's being generated by the tenants through this taxation program is being reinvested with the goal of creating additional opportunities for additional jobs. So the tax credit from some of the individual tenants and companies that are located there is a very critical analysis on their point as to whether or not they're going to locate on the reservation or not. And so I would highly recommend the passage of this bill. It is a very, very useful tool and continue to be useful in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. I think you made a pretty persuasive case for it. I'm curious more than anything else, is if this works this way and then this applies to all of the tribal lands, why is it so small? Why is it so underutilized or not used very often? I mean, it seems like it makes that case, and you've got, you know, $37 million development here and 450 jobs here. Why are the numbers so small? Why isn't it used more?
You know, talking with I co-chair the Economic Development and Community Services Cluster, and I know several tribes are looking at putting this into place. Several tribes just don't own appropriate industrial lands either yet, looking to to acquire those. I know Warm Springs in particular more recently have talked about it. Sillette certainly has. Grand Ronde, you know, a number of tribes have talked about putting these into place, but it's a matter of finding that right location. And especially, as I described before, some of the land tenure doesn't necessarily coincide with where their community is, where their good industrial land is. So, you know, I think it's another tool in the toolbox for those tribes.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Berquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have about three or four questions, but I want to start out by prefacing. I sort of see this as a tribal nation state issue here, and we should get rid of the double taxation. I got that. But you sort of also opened, I think, the question that Senator Haas brought up, which is Pandora's box. And I think I know the answer to this, but I'm trying to find out because – so a couple of questions. The enterprise zone as it's structured, the reservation tribal enterprise zone as it's structured now, is really different than the definition of tribal lands and tribal reservation lands. The reservation zone can be created on what you call tribal lands. I think it was mentioned you have a business park out at the Port of Umatilla, and you have one, so on and so forth. So is that correct? So this could be applied to a reservation enterprise zone, which is could in fact be on tribal lands that are not specifically reservation under the federal statutes. Is that right?
Correct. At least, well, and for our property down at the Port of Umatilla, it's in trust land, too.
Okay, exactly.
So we have to go through that process where
right.
it converts into federal ownership where we have the
right.
possessory use
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, right. So follow up. And then you mentioned the Coyote Business Park, and I'm running through my mind and trying to figure out why this isn't more effective, but I think I know the answer. My assumption is that, and I know the answer sort of this question, but is are some of the entities that are in the Coyote Business Park or similar, are they Native American 8As, which I think most of you then know they're similar to ANC 8As.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you have in the Coyote Business Park, or you have a different entity?
No, none of our companies are 8A certified. Let me see. I think and Bruce or Rosinda could probably help me. Arrowhead Truck Stop, Cayuse Technologies. Several of them are properties and businesses we own.
Right.
Several are private sector kind of investment sort of properties. The Kenworth, DaVita's one that has multi, you know, kind of franchise dialysis unit where they have other operations. But no, we don't. Go ahead.
I was going to say we kind of have a variety of tenants. And we actually have the U.S. Forest Service actually located at the Coyote Business Park. So that was, a multi-million-dollar building that was constructed. You had 60, 65 employees that were there. But because it's owned by the U.S. Forest Service, they do pay, through their lease payments, they do pay the Coyote Business Park tax because they're a tenant there. However, because they're the federal government, they're not eligible for the tax credit. And so we have several businesses that are located that are tenants but are not eligible for the credit. But it's interesting in talking with even some of those tenants that necessarily aren't tax-paying entities that would take advantage of this, they do look at this reservation enterprise zone as a positive because they're looking at it as the overall regulatory framework and saying, wow, the state of Oregon and the tribes have actually gotten together and have agreed on something in a positive nature. And so they view that as a positive, even though they're not eligible to take the credit. So there are other benefits in addition to just the companies, they themselves, being able to make a income tax deduction on their Oregon income taxes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So, and I guess it's an accounting question for you, but not in accounting speak, please. So flip over to the taxpayer that's talking to the CPA. What we're really looking at in this whole structure of law here, this and the tax credit and everything else, is that in a normal situation, you would be deducting what would be considered a fee or an income tax from a city of Portland example, right? And in this case, the way we've structured this, it is a tax credit if there is a tribal tax or a tribal fee. Is that pretty much correct?
That is
analogy
correct.
Is the same.
The analogy would be the same. The amount of money they're paying us at the Coyote Business Park, let's say they pay us $5,000 in property taxes, that would be the amount that they would then be eligible potentially for the tax credit against any Oregon income tax liability they may owe. My understanding in reading the credit, it's a non-refundable credit, and it's a non-carryover credit, so they either have to use it in that year or it's gone.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chairman? I know you won't know, so let's go to, do any of the tribal members have a clue why we did this way in 2001? I mean, this is a very strange way to solve this problem. You would think you would have just made the deduction instead of creating the credit and doing what we're saying. There was a whole lot tax purpose wise easier ways to have done this than the way we did it. Mm-hmm. In any idea how we use this method? Because instead we should have made it a deduction, and as you point out, it's very unusual. It is not refundable, and you know it's not carry forward, which are two more anomalies to the tax system too.
Right.
How did we in 2001 decided to do it this way? Anybody know?
Meaning using our own authorities to just do.
No,
that,
I mean,
or?
We came to the state, and we in the state decided that we were going to build this law here, and this is a very hard way to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish, and I'm trying to figure out why we did it this way.
Well, it's largely modeled on the state enterprise zone.
It was through the enterprise zone that came around that way,
yeah,
versus the income tax type of structure the other direction.
Yeah, I can remember because I was actually there in 2001 and was part of these discussions. And the reason it was structured the way it was in the form of a tax credit rather than a tax deduction was the idea or concept behind it was that an individual is paying the tribe a property tax of $2,000, for example. And so the idea was to give them a potential tax credit of $2,000. So therefore, from a cash standpoint, it would be revenue neutral to the taxpayer themselves because, in effect, they were paying the tribe $2,000 in property tax, but getting a tax credit dollar for dollar of $2,000. And so at that point, the idea was to eliminate the double taxation of the county property tax and the tribal property tax. And so it was structured in the form of a tax credit because there was a discussion about not wanting to diminish the county's abilities to collect local property taxes off that same property. And so that's why the credit mechanism was put in place.
Senator Riley, did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. From listening to your folks' testimony, it sounds to me like the most important part of all this is the enterprise zone itself and not the tax credit. The tax credit is very minor compared to the actual enterprise zone.
In terms of revenue or, yeah, right.
Absolutely. and so and since so few people actually take this and it's such a small thing, and you keep talking about the fact that it's important because it shows a partnership with the state, and that's what the enterprise zone does. That has nothing to do with the tax credit. So my point is that we're not looking at any way to touch the enterprise zone. That's not anything that we're looking at this point. Just so you're clear on that. We're not looking at in any way touching that. I'm perfectly happy to extend the sunset for this. And keep it in place. Personally, I'm philosophically opposed to open-ended tax credits with no sunset. But I think this is a reasonable, very reasonable tax credit, if there is such a thing, and would be willing to extend it. But to eliminate it is not some place that I'm personally willing to go.
Sure.
Senator Buckley.
I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum of my good senator down here. I fully understand, but this is the problem. We just you know, a little background. We saw another tax credit yesterday, and really it's not a tax credit. It's a deduction. But when you do the deduction, you end up with this convoluted thing. And as you say, now you have property taxes and credit, so the best way to do it is a credit. I think the other end of the spectrum in terming, you know, and I'm fine because it's a nation state issue of fixing it, whatever we need to fix, including just eliminating the sunset. But to my good colleague to my right, which is not very often, he's on my right, by the way, let me go back to the enterprise zone. What is this, the normal? I mean, obviously, you've been at the years, and I've been in Native American 8A operations. I've been in ANSI 8A operations. That's why I ask, because when it sounded like you were doing a Native American 8A, and, of course, there are a bunch of reasons why we don't have those, economically speaking, and I think there's two tax experts here know that why. But my question here is in the enterprise zone that you're having, are we looking at a 10-year, what do you look the types of people, you say you have 36 million in one, are you looking at 10-year business plans, 20-year business plans? I mean, because what we're trying to do here is ensure that, and I know exactly what you're getting at, because even though they're taking cents on the dollar, they don't want to be eight years into a XYZ and $30 million investment and magically we're in double taxation. Mm-hmm. Because this number could turn to $1 million overnight. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is the investment spectrum? Are you 5 to 10 years, 15 to 20s, in terms of some of the people that you're having? Because if I recall correctly, you built a building. So now we're talking the life cycle of a building, which might be 20, 30, or 40 years. You follow where I'm...
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. What was Cayuse business? Cayuse technology, that's 25-year loan. So I think for larger buildings, right. 3, 4, or 5 million, that's probably the... A debt cycle, but but you make an excellent point, in terms of the sunset, because you'd want to try to provide that surety to your investors.
Exactly.
We have on the federal side, some other tax benefits that have to be reapproved each year. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the net effect of those is, can I count on that next year or the Congress following? And so that's why we kind of make the case for a sunset or for no sunset.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you for coming down and
thank you.
Educating
thank
you. Us on your
thank you very much
situation.
For your time.
Jody Weiser.
Just not important, though.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hass, members of the committee, Jody Weiser. And I'm not confident about what I'm saying. During Senator Taylor's PERS meeting yesterday, I got a message from the person in our group that was reviewing this tax credit, and they said, we can't find any records of any jobs. There doesn't seem to be any transparency about it. They were just struggling with it. They said, look at it. So I started looking at it last night, and I haven't had a chance to talk to any tribal members or to Chris or anyone else about the concerns that we came up with. But the concerns are twofold. So far, the experience is only with a reservation enterprise zone that is on tribal property away from a port or another major business center. And while our other enterprise zones require jobs and require that the jobs be in the traded industries, this tax credit doesn't seem to have that kind of requirement. So a gas station or a restaurant would be eligible. And so what we can imagine is that if you have a facility that is near a center of population, pretty soon all the restaurants in town are going to be on the tribal property. And not only would Sherry's or Chevron's local taxes be available to be tax credited, but it looks like their taxes, income taxes from properties across the state would also be eligible to be exempted. And so our concern is we shouldn't be removing the sunset when we have so little experience with actual practice and what might happen over time. There is a bill, Senate Bill 176, that just extends the sunset for 6 years as we normally do. We would urge you to use that measure to work this bill. It's unclear in our reading whether a tribe could have only 112 square miles of enterprise zone spread on their reservation or on their tribal properties and off, or whether they could actually have more than that, but 12 square miles is a lot of land. It is two-thirds of Beaverton or two-thirds of Salem. It's twice as big as Forest Grove. It's bigger than Milwaukee or Newburgh, and even more square miles. It's about twice as big as Milwaukee or Newburgh, and more square miles than McMinnville or Oregon City. And so you can kind of imagine that someday in the future we'll have these new cities grow up around areas that pay no taxes. And we don't need that. And it made me wonder when I drive to Bellingham, I pass a couple of different places now where there are, it looks like 100 Freightliner trucks. And it's like, why do I never see 100 Freightliner trucks next to the freeway in Oregon, and I see them next to the freeway in Washington State? There is probably a tax advantage here, and we might be opening ourselves up for that sort of thing. So I urge you to retain a sunset on this tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Any questions? Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145. You might note that it does have a subsequent referral to the Tax Credits Committee, and so we'll be taking that up in the coming days. So I'll close the public hearing and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 156, Transportation. And that is Mazin.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 156 comes to you. This is a committee bill, pre-session filed, and to give you an idea, the genesis of this bill started, I believe, with the discussions that were going around the Measure 97. Mm-hmm. And this one would have discussed the issues of how the taxes from the minimum taxes for the sales of fuel were under the restriction of the constitutional highway fund definitions. And therefore, at the time, we were looking at how these issues to be resolved. So two things I think this bill introduces is to basically verify this idea, this concept, and this is a legislative council opinion on that, and basically start exercising that type of identification of revenue and transferring it to the highway fund, and at the same time asking ODOT and Department of Revenue to find a way to identify and accomplish this definition of revenue and transfer. So I asked both Department of Revenue and ODOT are here to talk to you about these issues, and also alerted Legislative Council to be listening and in case you need more input for this issue.
And, Mazin, this has to do with constitutional requirement, is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And the Constitution refers to sales of motor vehicle fuel?
That is correct.
And some of that corporate minimum, a portion of it, should have been going into the highway fund.
That is the conclusion that Legislative Council came to.
But it hasn't so far. Had Measure 97 passed with its giant rate that all of a sudden, if we pay attention to this section and do what we should have been doing all along, we are at, it would have been about $200 million, if I recall.
$453 million for a biennium.
For a biennium, yes. Into the highway fund. So obviously it didn't pass, but this issue was there, and so, okay.
That's
so we're trying to this bill exactly deals with this issue.
Deals with that. So let's call up our experts here: Deanna Mack, Jeff Henderson, and Daniel Porter. You could come up and Deanna, maybe you could add some perspective to this story.
Mazen, do you say Elsie's watching on the videotape?
Yes.
They're probably going to have to come down here.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And Mazen did a good job of explaining kind of the genesis of this issue. First, before I talk about like the practical application of the bill, we do have a question about another constitutional provision that requires the personal and corporate income tax revenues to go into the general fund and be used in the calculation of the kicker. The corporate kicker now goes into the state school fund, if there is one. So we have a potentially conflicting constitutional provisions related to the corporate minimum tax. The $150 corporate minimum tax that is fixed and non-apportionable is not a question here. That's for the S corporations. It's the rated, the bracketed rates that are for C corporations. So, assuming though that the revenues are supposed to go into the state highway fund, we have some technical issues with the bill here. First, on page one, in line six, it says as soon as practicable after the end of each calendar, or excuse me, fiscal quarter. And this is an annual tax return, and corporate tax returns are based on annual Oregon sales. They are generally 2 years behind in data, just because right now we're working with 2014 corporate tax returns, because they're generally fiscal year filers. And the data is usually not available. They can usually file on extension. They're complex taxpayers. And so it's about a year and a half to 2 years before we have any usable analysis from a particular tax year. We would that little provision there is inconsistent with the quarterly versus annual tax. In line seven, the Department of Revenue, in consultation with the Department of Transportation, shall determine. And it goes on. We're not entirely sure what we would consult on. The corporate tax return is confidential. It doesn't talk about the release, the ability for us to share tax return information with our partners at ODOT. But it could be that it means for ODOT to share information with us. So clarity probably there would be necessary. It's not entirely clear when a minimum tax receipt is attributable to a specific sale of motor vehicle fuel. There are several ways to deal with it, and as I think that Jeff here gave an overview last week about corporate taxation, the consolidated return can have a lot of information about a lot of different types of entities in there. There are entities that sell fuel and sell retail. I mean, there's large retail establishments that do both. At what point do we determine what amount of their sales is attributable to a rate change between one bracket to the next? Is it a ratio? Is it the difference between the brackets? How do we determine what tax revenue, minimum tax revenue, is attributable to that specific sale of fuel? So the clarity there would be most helpful.
Well, do you have some ideas on that?
We don't, actually. We would want to work with you and with LC, with DOJ, with our partners, our sister agencies, to kind of come up with some solution there to figure that out.
Because this is what came up during the campaign is, okay, does this mean, Costco selling tires or less, they all go to motor fuel. So we definitely need to clarify this, because it's
Mr. Chair,
that's huge.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's very complex to try and pinpoint how much of that particular minimum tax sale is attributable to a sale of motor vehicle fuel or other product of propulsion of a motor vehicle. That's another point I wanted to make. We're not entirely clear what that means. If it includes biofuels, for example, if it includes solar panels or electric batteries on vehicles, those all now propulse vehicles. We're not entirely sure how that would work. The bill in line nine on page one only asks us to do what that which is attributable to the Oregon to the sales of motor vehicle fuel in Oregon. But down in line 29 and then onto page 2, line 1, it does reference the other product used for the propulsion of motor vehicles, which is part of the language of the Constitution. So we would want to have some clarity there as well.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Buckles.
Deanna, just so you know, because apparently we're a lot farther ahead in the legislature than DOR, right? So I'll just point that out to you, because let me give you an example. A battery does fall under the fuel oil tax. There's a court ruling for that one. Oddly enough, tires do not. So the complexity of this with DOJ and so on and so forth is really, really, really technical.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge is that, I mean, and we started this discussion June or July when we started the fuel oil discussion because we realized the amount of there. And had we be implementing Measure 97 right now, it appears to me that we'd have Houston have a real problem because it's $500 million under 97. And what we really need is solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't going to go away because just because 97 didn't pass, we still have this constitutional piece right here. And there's all kinds of people out there. As soon as we say we're going to do a tax reform, they're going to want to sue the crap out of us on this thing. And between Department of Transportation, you guys, and Justice, I mean, I guess I'm expressing my displeasure that this is not a new topic. We knew this was going to be a $1 billion problem if 97 passed, and we knew that there was a $13 million hole in the past, which means holding the liability. And so I do understand what you're saying, but what you're sort of saying is everybody took a wait-and-see attitude knowing we're going to have to fix this regardless, which doesn't do very well for us.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair Boquist, we are consulting with our sister agency, and we do have questions to our DOJ. We don't have answers yet for those questions. We are not sitting on our laurels. We have been looking at this. So I appreciate your comment. We do, if this bill does go forward, we do need some amendments to the for the technical nature of it. But we are working on working that.
And I'm specifically beating up DOR, but transportation is there as justice. But let me just point out, it is the law of the land right now. All we're trying to do is make sure everybody gets some clarity that we should be following the law that already exists. And none of us, nobody would have challenged this thing. I think there's an estimate out there that says it would be $10 to $13 million over a biennium. And as you point out, we could spend $10 to $13 million just figuring this thing out. I do get that. It's just that, you know, we're looking at a major transportation plan, and any time you start talking fuel oils and balance, it's there. But what just jumped out at me, so you're very clear, is that, you know, we've already looked at legal opinions, even from DOJ, that tells us that God knows why tires aren't and batteries are, but it is. And so the DOJ lawyers that are advising you need to do a whole lot better coordination.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Senator Boquist, may I continue?
Yep.
Okay.
And again, I'm not mad at you.
Yeah,
I'm just
I know. So just to summarize the question, issues that the agencies have with this is, one, we would like to have some clarity between the two provisions in the Constitution. Both are in Article 9 of the Constitution, one related to the fund that goes into for education, and then this to the highway fund, the potentially conflicting provision there. And I do believe we have to work with LC and DOJ to get to that place. We would recommend that the change go from quarterly to annually. And we would like you to address the confidentiality provisions if there are some. And then we'd like to have clear guidance on how much we apportion, how we apportion, whether it's a ratio or whether it's the difference between the brackets or some other method that maybe we haven't thought of. And then also some definitions relating to products that are used for the propulsion of motor vehicles, whether it's tires or not, as an example. And we commit to working with our partner agencies, DOJ, Legislative Council, and this body, to come to these answers. So if you have any other questions about this.
Just the batteries are fuel and tires are not. I'm sorry.
God knows why the court ruling. It's a court ruling, okay?
Yeah.
Senator, the it's not the fuel that the battery propels the motor vehicle.
It's a fuel.
The propulsion.
So, but the tires are?
Are not. I mean, it's an equivalency to motor fuel, and a battery is fuel. It's just not oil, right? Yep. It's a fuel, and it fuels the car and makes it go. Tires do not.
Right. the propulsion.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Deanna, you rattled off a couple here. You've obviously slots. You're already ahead of us in some ways. So varieties of discussions you've had of how you could do this, proportionate formula, mm-hmm. a percentage of sales. And, of course, the problem with you guys, this is going to fall to the taxpayer because there's no information on tax return if we do this. We're going to have to tell, I don't know, British Petroleum or whoever that, you know, hey, what percentage of this is X and which percentage is Y? But mm-hmm. Have you guys thought through any, you know, what-ifs or courses of action? I heard you use proportionate formula. Any discussion you mm-hmm. guys have had or thoughts on how it might work?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, we have actually had some conversations about like in the chair's example of Costco, they're a huge retailer and they also have motor vehicle fuel sales, right? So whatever the ratio is of those sales, you could apply that to the minimum tax, numerator and denominator, and apply that to the minimum tax. That is one possible way. Another possible way is to show, you know, with the minimum tax, there's the brackets that just, there's cliffs in each bracket. Right. And it, you could just attribute, you know, you could do other sales up to a certain threshold, and then motor vehicle fuels, if it triggers it into the next, then the difference between the two rates. There are different ways we could do that, and that could work. It would require substantial education on the part of, on our part to the taxpayer, changes in forms and instructions to make sure it's clear that that's what they need to do and that they need to start tracking those differences in organ sales. So yeah, we have been giving it thought on how we would implement it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I mean, just a couple of things that jump out that we've had in previous discussions. I mean, for example, God knows why we did this too, but Agriculture Department does metering and flow meters that go through the meters. And of course, if you have liquid fuels, they got to go through the meters. So we've even talked about, there's one metric. Mm-hmm. The other metric, of course, is, you know, the bulk gas tax distribution. The distributors know where the fuel has gone to, so on and so forth. Like that. I don't have an answer because it's too complex. All I know is if we'd have been at $453 million, we'd be coming up with an answer in the next 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Now we have a luxury of a little bit more time to figure out how to do it across the board. But, and Mr. Chair, I actually do think Legislative Council has opined on the article. Help me out here, Mawson.
Article 9.
The Article 9, I think, has already been opined on. So someone from Legislative Council could at least give us their position. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. I have nothing further.
Okay. You guys are weighing in.
I brought Jeff with me in case you had any corporate tax questions. Sure. Brought him with me, but Dan is here too.
Did you talk about propulsion? Was the what were those crystals in the USS Enterprise?
Dilithium.
Dilithium.
Mr. and Back to the Future, remember bananas were in too. You just dropped the banana into the new machine. And
but not tires.
But not tires.
They don't propel.
Well, you know,
they allow movement.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
All right.
So, Chair Haas,
yes.
Members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Porter, an economist at Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm just here to really, Deanna did a great job of highlighting kind of the concerns that we have jointly with them on this bill. And so our role here is really just to offer whatever analysis, data, support we can to them and Justice or Legislative Council, LRO, to kind of get them the information that we need to be able to get to some answers to this.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator
Buckley. I'm just food for thought, thinking out loud, and some of us, unfortunately, have had far too many meetings on this topic in the last 6 or 7 months. But, you know, one of the proportionate analysis does come back to addressing fuel, oil, and gas tax. You know, if an entity is paying, a distributor is paying X amount in gas tax, that starts to give you a proportional formula. Because even if you came up with a proportional formula, I mean, where do you start? How do you even guess at it? And I don't know if that particular distributorship more is in DOR and collections of gas tax or over in Department of Transportation. But it is rather a complex issue, and I don't know if DOT has any insights or theories of what we might approach.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, the fuel piece is even more complex because of the heavy vehicle, right?
6535, yes.
And so you have the highway cost allocation constitutional requirement for the light and heavies,
right.
And then also heavy trucks pay weight mile tax.
Right.
So it's not, they don't currently pay fuel tax. So that And where gasoline is taxed is a different place than where diesel is taxed and the supply chain. And the information that we have really good information on the motor vehicle fuel, so which is basically gasoline. And we know how much tax revenue we have. We know how many gallons are taxed, so how much is sold. The diesel piece or the heavy use that goes with the weight mile is really an estimate that's kind of done by us and by FHWA. And so it's the numbers are right now about 2.1 billion gallons a year are used.
Right. Hey, Mr. Chairman, that's why I suggested, oddly enough, again, why we did this, is the meters that actually pump the fuel, even diesel fuel, are regulated by the Department of Agriculture, mm-hmm. and there are meter counts on the meters, which are then retained during the inspection process.
So, measures.
So there's a measure. The problem is that measure wasn't designed for this measure, and how we access that measure and whether it's valid is, you know, completely new. But just to tell you mm-hmm. that there are other areas. That's why this is complex. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator.
Continuing to.
Taylor. I just had a quick question. Thank you, Senator Jeff. Remind me of your name again.
Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, Jeff Henderson.
Yes, thank you. You did a great job the other day. I just had a question. Obviously, many states grapple with how they manage and administer their gas tax. It's not unique what's happening in Oregon. Do we have a sense of what goes on in other states? Are you able to? There must be some modeling that you can draw from.
Mr. Chair, Senator Taylor, I'm not aware of what other states are doing. I personally haven't been involved with that.
Oh, okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, for Senator corporate. Taylor, the Department of Revenue, it's unusual because we do administer most of the tax programs, but our partners here at ODOT actually administer the fuels tax.
Okay, so well then, I guess to him then, for the question, because I think every state has a gas tax, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so of the 50 states, there must be a model that the economists can draw from to play out the different scenarios and get to us some possibilities pretty, right?
Right. Senator Taylor, we have, like I said, we have a really good idea of how much fuel is sold and the taxable piece of it. The connection then to the income tax piece of it is
right.
is that's the part that hasn't been put together yet.
Follow up?
Follow
yeah,
up.
Thank you, Chair Hess. Is there another state that you're aware of that does have this requirement?
We could do some researching.
I don't know. I'm just trying to understand, because obviously you're going to need to do some modeling to figure out, build an infrastructure in order to administer the tax, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Chair Hatch, Senator Taylor, that's something that I think that we can work on together and get back to you.
Okay. That's, all right. Sounds good.
Mr. Chair, I want to follow up.
Go ahead.
Just that. Mazen, correct me if I'm wrong. Or Paul sitting over there, and you better pay attention, is that in actuality, I believe Ohio, Nevada, and Texas both have constitutional amendments for highway fund, and both have gross receipts tax or versions of the CAT, which are exactly parallel to what we were talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Very similar.
Well, that was correct. My question, too, is how unusual is this being in the Constitution, and maybe is part of the solution here a constitutional referral, to clarify it or take out the propulsion or eliminate it altogether?
We're willing to work with you on figuring that out in the next few weeks.
Take it out.
Yeah, we certainly are. It's confusing, and we would like to have the opportunity to work with our sister agencies and LC and DOJ and come together to a centralized place on how we can actually do this if we needed to.
We don't have to go on transportation.
That was one of the thoughts.
Never fly.
If Measure 97 would have passed, you get it.
Right.
Solve that.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
It created 15 more.
I think the Legislative Council is standing right over there.
Yes, Alan is here.
And again, I'm not mad at you. I'm just the flash of the obvious.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there are a lot of examples of different states not only having this issue, because two of them do, but sales tax on gasoline also happens in other places. So, I mean, it is difficult for us because we're not used to it.
Okay.
It's not impossible or unheard of, but I'm sure that, Oregon has been able to do things and do them very well at different times and be ahead of the pack. And I'm sure that probably will not stop this time. However, there is usually a space, a legal space, between the AGs and the LC. And sometimes it's good to live in that space. However, sometimes it is good to actually do something and allow courts to give us opinion of whether this understanding is right or that understanding is right. So it is not all bad after all.
Right. And we just like to be able to work with LC and DOJ and come to some sort of an understanding rather than a back and forth about what is right. We want to get to that place. So we're committing to working with you on that.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you all three. We do have legislative counsel standing by, Al and Dale. Maybe have the last word on this.
Solved. Pandora's box. It's the first
word. Last word for today.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. And first, I'd like to say that LC doesn't have the final word about anything. Second, I want to say that there was one thing that I believe is incorrect that was said before, which is that batteries would not be covered by, or so revenue attributable to corporate minimum tax revenue attributable to Oregon sales of batteries would not be subject to Article 9, Section 3A. If you look into the history of the constitutional provision, the language dates from 1942, and it is very clear from the voters' pamphlet and from the gas tax and highway fund tax statutes on the books at the time that what they meant by, talking about the phrase, any other product used for the propulsion of motor vehicles, they meant combustible liquid fuel. So batteries, electricity, don't come under that purview. I'm sorry. What other questions
do
you have?
We're looking at this bill, Senate Bill 156, and sort of how to get our hands around, okay, if this is, you know, from your ruling, your LC ruling, then if this is now, regardless of what happened to the ballot measure, which is where this first was sort of discovered, and it was during that time frame, how should we clarify it? And, how should the Department of Revenue handle this? How should people be informed? And what I'm wondering is it something we can fix and clarify statutorily, or is this a constitutional referral to take maybe out that, to remove that propulsion language, or to just remove it altogether?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I add to that before he starts? And then what DOR said, as pointed out, is that Article 9 of the Constitution has the highway fuel oil portion, and then there's, in DOR's mind, the other portion that says all the money goes to the school fund. So does the money go to the highway fund, or does the money go to the school fund? And okay. The two are competing in the Constitution is at least what DOJ must be telling them.
Right. So Chair Haas, members of the committee, first, with respect to the constitutional conflict pointed out by the Department of Revenue, Deanna was talking about Article 9, Section 14, I think. And so the description of that, the revenue that sort of suggests that it might have to go a different place than the state highway fund, it says that the description of the revenue is revenues that will be received by the general fund. And in my mind, these are not revenues that will be received by the general fund, because Article 9, Section 3A, which predates Section 14, says that they have to go to the state highway fund. It's a little tricky because Article 9, Section 3A predates this provision, but the changes to the corporate minimum tax statute post-date it. obviously, our office believes that if those changes had been made, say, in the 80s, then the corporate minimum tax that's attributable to Oregon sales of motor vehicle fuel should have been going to the state highway fund from that point. There is a conflict, I think, though, and I haven't been asked this question before, I haven't researched it, but it seems to me that the two can be read together, and there's certainly a judicial doctrine saying that if you can read two provisions of the Constitution together, then you should, and I think they can be, but I have not looked at that before. Then in terms of the technique for determining how much of the corporate minimum tax is attributable to Oregon sales of motor vehicle fuel, I mean, one thing I'm pretty sure of is that our office shouldn't be figuring out the technique. And that is why we threw into the bill Department of Revenue and Department of Transportation, figuring that these were the agencies with the greatest competency. I will say that this issue has come up in Ohio, and there is a Ohio, they have a similar constitutional provision dedicating revenue from sales of motor vehicle fuel to their state highway fund, and they have a commercial activity tax, which is like the corporate minimum tax, a gross receipts tax. And there was a challenge from taxpayers who sell motor vehicle fuel and from local agencies who rely on their state highway fund for their transportation projects, challenging the statute because that money was not being dedicated to their state highway fund. And so the Ohio Supreme Court held that that money did have to be dedicated to the state highway fund, and it wasn't any easier for them to figure out just how much that money was. Looking at their statutes, it looks like what they did was for 1 year made people actually figure out exactly how much was attributable. So an actual accounting of the amounts of the commercial activity tax revenues that were attributable to sales of motor vehicle fuel. And then they created basically ratios, averages, that they then applied going forward. They also separated out the petroleum activity tax from the commercial activity tax, made it a separate exaction, and I think in order to make the administration easier. So that's how Ohio handled pretty much an identical problem. Mm-hmm. But this was delegated on purpose to agencies. If there need to be more agencies or different agencies, that's fine. But, with books, I can't figure out exactly how it should be done.
Well, I think that's the goal here, if this is, is to make it as easy as possible for the agencies to administer, to make it as clear as possible for taxpayers. I don't know if we can get there in a statute, given what constitutes propulsion these days.
I mean, I can draft anything they think is the best way to go, and I'm happy to. I'm not wedded to this, but as a starting point, the idea was to get it in the right hands, and frankly, admitting they weren't mine.
I think this rises to kind of the level of a.
Oh, I'm sorry. You asked something else about the whether it should be addressed in the Constitution.
Well, that would be one way to deal with it.
Yes, but my hesitation about that, or at least would be to think about Measure 50 and if it is actually going to be a complex process that we wouldn't necessarily get right the first time, then it might not be a good idea to put it in the Constitution.
Well, my thought was just remove or repeal that section.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. not
good luck.
So yeah, it's always difficult getting
very.
We passed the higher ed bill without a fight in the last session, but Senator Boquist, would you mind volunteering to head up a small work group?
I'm already doing this already, so I'm not volunteering. I've already been voluntold
on this. On this issue, though, right, this precise issue.
Let me follow up and so that we can get counsel to clarify so that the members of the committee understand. And because Lenny flashed the obvious twice now, one from DOR and one from what Alan just said right now, and you and I have had this discussion, and I think Alan needs to pontificate upon this so we understand, is that you can't have a cat. The commercial activities tax under the Oregon Constitution right now, if you created a, just pick, I don't know, a 0.5 cat commercial activities tax, right? You can't do that because you have to have a PAT with it, because we have a constitutional obstacle to this, is as if you created a cat.
You have to have a what with it?
A PAT. That's what they have, a petroleum activities tax, which is the legal case he's talking about when their cat was challenged. They then had to go back and create a petroleum activities tax because if you have fuel oil company out here is doing fuel oil, when you tax them under the cat, they still have to put that money into the highway fund. So anything you talk about doing with a gross activities tax or a cat, you must resolve this issue before you get to that issue, because the petroleum companies and the fuel oil companies would then be subject to putting the money in the highway fund, and this solution right here has to be part of that discussion. Am I not correct?
Chair Hass, Senator Boquist, I'm not sure that they were required to create the PAT. I think that they did it because it made sense to administer that. But it's true that the Supreme Court of Ohio said that the commercial activity tax monies, revenue that was attributable to sales of motor vehicle fuel, had to go into their state highway fund.
Thank you, Chair Hass. So in Ohio, did they have the competing constitutional challenge of the education fund is also, or?
Chair Hass, Senator Taylor, I don't know. I can find
it. No, I was just curious. Maybe you know.
Senator, no, that's a new one to me. That one actually is slightly new, other than we've had a legal opinion, not from Alan, but from someone else, that has said yes, mm-hmm. but no. It goes the exact same. The money's mm-hmm. supposedly general fund, and even though mm-hmm. there's a technicality in our bookkeeping system in which we throw it into the pot and then we take it back out of the pot, it's only temporary as accounting mechanism go through. It's really not. The fuel oil money is really not in the general fund, even though there's some people who say, well, the treasurer connected it and it's kind of commingled, but it really is due for the other one. But it still begs the difference is that in the CAT, you have the constitutional problem here, just like on here. You either create a PAT or you go into the commercials activities tax and you create this formula. That's your choice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we're talking about this, just as a dynamic, I mean, we estimated about, you know, it was a floating number, so we'll say half a billion dollars under 97. So if 97 had been half as small, that's still $250 million. And if it had been a quarter the size, that's still $125 million.
Okay, you're assigned to this part of the. Thanks for volunteering for this work group.
Well, no, this is already, transportation's already dealing with this issue.
Yeah, okay.
So now it's dual focus, which means legislative council and everybody else needs to ratchet it up one more thing here.
Thank you. I agree with that. It is dual focus now, and we do have to ratchet it up.
Did you want me to help, Mr. Chair, or just
please.
Stay away, please?
No. goes without saying.
And since we're so good in revenue versus transportation, I just want you to know there's already a meeting being coordinated between the elf cities and Mazin and I. So we're already, you know, took us all of 3 seconds to get this moving.
All right. Any further comments or questions?
Nope.
Thanks for coming down.
Sure.
Okay. This is our last meeting of the week. See you on Monday.
Okay.
All right. We are adjourned.
Hey, Mazda. Scientific.
We are adjourned.
Hey, Mazda. Scientific.